You're not gonna say it, somebody should. Let's talk about two time. Let's talk about bum one, yeah. Asking the questions that nobody could. Like, where are the bone thugs and are they in harmony? You're a helpful snowman.
Oh, hey, everybody. Well, we did a drive to the airport, and now a drive home from the airport. And I think we talked about the Narrow Your Horizons reading challenge, so I hope you all enjoyed that shit. And now I've kind of boned myself, because now I can't reverse these. Although, I guess I could. Maybe I could and just be like, ooh, this is a out-of-order story. Which is a great segue into what we're going to talk about today. Two parts today. Two things on the docket. One of them is to talk about Black Mirror Bandersnatch, but also the general idea of choose your own adventure narrative. The other is to talk about AI written novels. And I was having a hard time deciding which order to go in. Because I was like, well, Bandersnatch, do people give a shit about that? Do people give a shit? And also, if I say, I'm going to talk about this, do people then turn this off because they're like, eh, fuck it. I mean, I don't care about that, so I'm going to just move on. Or is it better to talk about that first so then I can talk about my own crazy shit afterwards? You know? What's the worst way to do a podcast? This is a continuous exercise in what is the worst way to do a thing? That's kind of my life. What's the worst way to do a thing? What's the worst way to have a long-term relationship? Probably to live in different states. Probably the dumbest way to do it. Except, you know, for, I guess, living in another country. Even that, I'm like, well, yeah, that would be horrible. That would be tough. Although, I guess if my significant other was moving to another country, it would just have to be like, well, you gotta either go or break up, right? Like, those are the only options. There's no, like, let's stay together for the next 2 to 5 years and see each other 2 times. That would just be awful. And, like, we're not even in the same time zone, so it's, can't even really talk regularly. I have to get up at 6 a.m. so I can talk to you. And then we feel that disconnect over the whatever. This is getting Black Mirror-y, so let's talk about Black Mirror. I decided to just start talking and let it be my guide. It's kind of funny, like, so I'm taking a writing class right now, and we had to do an exercise where you kind of had to come up with two characters and their quote-unquote voices. So, you know, nouns, verbs, adjectives that they would say and kind of their style of speech. And you had to come up with that before you started writing, which is very backwards, because for me it's normally like, I kind of just start and then figure it out as I go, and then, you know, and then once I figure it out, then going back and revising it down is very easy. Because you're like, okay, well, like, this was the beginning of the story and I didn't really know what this person sounded like yet. And now that I've finished the story, I know what they sounded like. So your second thing is where you kind of go through and start to be like, okay, I just got to make sure this person sounds the way they sound by the end from the beginning. Anywho, it was really different for me. But I was thinking about, that's also kind of how I do this, is like I just sort of talk and see where it goes rather than having super huge, structured, highly driven things, which probably does not make for ultimate better content. I mean, I would be very against this plan for writing, you know, writing a story. Anyone who's like, no, I did the first draft and that's it. Or they're like, I did a first draft and then I edited it, by which I mean I corrected some spelling errors. It's like, no, no, no. I always thought, like an easy way to teach a beginning fiction class would be to have them write, you know, short fictions. Because it's like, well, that way you can see the difference, but, and, you know, talk about how a story needs a beginning, middle, and end, even if it's short, and so on. But then also, because then what you do is you grade on revision. And not the goodness of the revision, but the effort. And you kind of, all you'd have to do is basically get a window with sun coming through it, and you would put the two sheets of paper with the stories, first and second draft, hold them up and be like, well, does this mostly line up or is it mostly different? And then you're like, all right, cool. Looks like you did some revision. The window pane test. Not the baking one, but the fiction writing one. Let's talk about Bandersnatch. I guess I will be spoiling some of this, so if you plan to watch it and you haven't watched it yet, I mean, just know that I'll spoil some of it. And, well, most of it. It's impossible to talk about without spoiling it. Alright, so here's what Bandersnatch is. Bandersnatch is an episode of Black Mirror, which, if you don't know what that is, it's kind of a technology-based Twilight Zone, I would call it. People like to make fun of it a little bit. I think the last season people really made fun of a lot because it was just basically like, what if Facebook was evil, is the kind of jokes people make. But I also feel like, Black Mirror is interesting and fun and overall, like, well done. Every once in a while, there's an episode that you're like, eh, could have done without this Robo Dog Terminator episode. Like, that didn't really give me much, but whatever. But I like that they're trying to do different things. And I think I always give the series credit because the first one is basically about a guy who's holding an entire country hostage in some fashion. And the only way for him, the only thing he'll allow is, or the only way he'll say, like, okay, I'm not going to do whatever he was going to do, is if the prime minister, like, fucks a pig on live television. And it totally happens. And it's kind of like the twist there is that the people of the country, you know, you'd think like, oh, they'd be so repulsed by the prime minister and they would hate him forever. And like, it's such a shaming thing to do. And it's like he kowtowed to this terrorist. But actually, the people kind of see him as this heroic figure because it was like, well, he was willing to do that for the safety of everyone else. And you're like, oh, that's interesting and different. And that was the first episode. So the first episode, it's not like it shows him, it does not show a penis entering a live pig, but it's like pretty close. As close as you could get on a television program. It showed more than I thought it was going to, let's put it that way. Overall, I like, it's one of the few newer shows that I've actually seen all of, and I like almost all of it. The ones that I disliked the most were, like, Robot Terminator Dog, because that was kind of pointless, and then I did not like San Junipero, which is, like, the one that everybody else seemed to really like. I think it showed, like, an idealized female friendship, which was, I'm sure, nice. I just didn't really care. And I thought that the stakes of it were very low because I'm not going to get into it, but it kind of shows basically this old person has two options and they're both, in my opinion, good options. Neither of them is a horrific option. It kind of deals with death and it's sort of like, well, you could have a standard death or you could have your consciousness live on forever in a machine that, you know, feels to you in every way as if it's real. And I think what bothered me about it is I was like, well, okay, I don't even have those options. Nobody living today even has that choice to make. So I don't really feel that strongly for this person who's like, oh, I have to make this really difficult choice. And I'm like, well, you've got the choice to live forever and feel like you're living forever. And everything's kind of great when you're living forever and you can be with this person you love. Or you can die and be with your husband who died and chose not to go into the machine because he just thought, like, I'm going into the hereafter, the next adventure, or maybe nothingness or whatever. I thought that was interesting because it was kind of like, yeah, it's this question of, is death a necessary thing? Like, what happens if there's no death anymore? But it wasn't even presented that way. It was more like, well, if I go to the afterlife computer world and I'm not really dead, then I'll never see my husband again. Whereas if I go to the regular afterlife, I'll be with my husband, whether that means I'll actually be with him or we'll just both be gone completely. We'll both be completely eradicated from the world. And I was like, I mean, in as much as death can be a win-win situation, this seems like a win-win. Also, that's the big thing about death, is I don't think we get a choice. And so when the show gives this choice, I'm sort of like, this is not like a heart-wrenching choice to me, I guess. I mean, and there was this added element because it's like she finds a female friend. Well, and I guess lover. I guess they were lovers. And so it's like, oh, because it's like the love that dare not speak its name in the can exist in the afterlife virtual world or whatever. But I was like, all right, that's fine. It just didn't. Should this person die and be with her husband and so on, or should she live on in the computer world forever and be with her girlfriend? I mean, both, she loves both of these people. She can't have both. She can't have, you know, it felt a little bit like the choice was, well, am I going to have cake or pie for dessert? And I like both cake and pie. And it's like, well, if I have the cake, I can't have the pie. But as a viewer watching for these characters, I'm kind of like, I don't know. I don't know how invested I am in that decision, and I'm not sure. Also, it doesn't invest you at all in the decision to just die and be with the husband, because you spend the whole time seeing her and this girl get together and be in love and, like, living in the virtual world, which is basically perfect. So it's sort of like, okay, well, and the husband is completely not in the story, and you don't really learn much about him and whatever, so you're kind of like, I guess I'll take your word for it that he's fucking awesome and that you miss him, but that's all I can really do to come to your side of the table here is take your word for it and assume that you're correct. Anyway, that was San Junipero, which I just talked about and said I wouldn't talk about and then just completely talked about. There's just no stakes. That's the problem. Like, you can't really write a story that's about, like, oh, this guy wins the lottery. Is he going to take the lump sum or the annuity? And it's like, well, who cares? I don't know if I really care about that very much at all. Or, you know, Jeff Bezos is getting a divorce, Bezos, whatever, I hear. And I think he's in a state where, I know some states are just 50-50, so it's like, whatever you've got when you get divorced, everyone, you know, the both parties split 50-50. Which is, like, I guess crazy, because you're like, I don't know, he's worth, like, billions of dollars. But on the other hand, you're like, Bezos having half as much as he had before is, I guess, a tremendous loss in terms of raw dollars, but I think he'll be okay in terms of money. I'm not super worried about him. He's gonna be out on the street. Anywho, let's talk about Bandersnatch. So Bandersnatch was an episode of this show or a movie in a choose-your-own-adventure style. So what this means is, as you're going along, you actually had to click on the screen and say, do you want to do this or this? You know, and like the beginning of it presents you with obviously, or at least seemingly unimportant choices. Which cereal do you want to eat for breakfast? Which of these two musics do you want to listen to? You know, and then that ends up being the soundtrack throughout the episode, right? And so you're making these choices that affect the story, but I wouldn't say they're important. It's not like, whatever. Now let me talk a little bit about my background with these. Because I've probably read something like 20-ish choose your own adventure books as an adult and tried a few different methods and to get through them and survive and be alive at the end of the book and or get to a good ending, which I think I've succeeded maybe once out of 20. And part of the problem is in choose your own adventure books, because one, I diagrammed one out. I talked about that on here, I believe, and I diagrammed one out. And it was like, if you made, okay, you make a very arbitrary choice at the beginning of this one. And based on that, it's like, all right, if you made choice A, you had a decent or better, I guess, shot of getting to a good ending. If you took choice B, you had like a 1 in 5 possibility. There was only one good ending that can come of that. And it was like a 1 of 5 chance, essentially, from the get-go. And that's based on a choice that seems to have no morality to it, no thinking. And that's what always bothered me about these books. That's not what always did, but as an adult, what bothered me about it that I think I couldn't put to words as a kid because I didn't really know. But what bothered me about them is it made choice just seem very arbitrary. Like, you weren't making choices that would really affect you, or it's kind of like, okay, you're going down a cave corridor and you could go left or right. And it's not like you could go left or right. Now, to the right, you see lights flickering on the edge of the cave, suggesting someone else is there. It could be friendlies, it could be enemies. To the left, it looks like it gets darker and there's nobody that way. And so it's like, okay, well, what's my situation? Am I trying to evade? Am I trying to find people? Am I going to get lost in these caves forever? Am I avoiding a monster? What's going on? It's just sort of like you could go left or right, and you're not really trying to do anything specific, nor are you trying to not do anything, avoid anything. So it's kind of just like a coin toss a lot of the time. So that's what's really frustrating about those books. And that's part of what I found frustrating about Bandersnatch. Overall, Bandersnatch shares a lot of the common flaws of the Choose Your Own Adventure book. And essentially, I think they both boil down to the same big problem, which is the novelty of the format belies the need to tell a story, is kind of the biggest problem. So, like, if you put Bandersnatch together, I'm not sure that it tells, like, a cohesive story. And even if it does, I don't think it's an interesting story. I think that this is a story that wouldn't work if it wasn't in a choose-your-own-adventure format. In as much as I think it would just be, people would be like, that's it? How is that even an episode of this show? But let's go back a little bit. So I'll kind of outline the basic plot for you. Like many of these Black Mirror episodes, you have a main character where you know something's up with them, but you don't know exactly what. He's like in his bedroom, and he lives with his dad. And his dad comes out of his bedroom and then has like a lock on the door from the outside. So he can leave his bedroom and then lock it from the outside, which he does. He's having the kid take pills of some kind, you know, of mysterious purpose. And so the kid is like an amateur video game designer. And he's designing a game called Bandersnatch, which is based on a book of the same name. Now, this book was created by some weird author. And it seems like, and it's this huge, giant choose-your-own-adventure novel that a lot of people think has this weird puzzle aspect to it, or like is saying something else. It's not real clear. It doesn't go into that a ton, but it's basically like, imagine if David Foster Wallace had written a super hard sci-fi fantasy choose your own adventure novel. So it was respected in that way as a literature tome, but also had this choose your own adventure element to it. And was fucking giant. That's probably why I went with David Foster Wallace, because it's like, you see that Infinite Jest and you're just like, well, maybe someday I'll go on a cruise or do something like that and be like, all right, I'm going to do this shit. I started reading the book Dune on this trip. so far, Dune is very crazy, and I'm not sure if I like it at all. There's like a million names, and each name also has a title with it, and like there's these different sort of clans. There's just so much world building, and like it reminds me of what I don't like about world building. Because like when I think of world building, because I think world building is something that people attribute a lot to sci-fi and fantasy and stuff like that, and Lord of the Rings and so on. But world building happens in any decent book. And I think what's challenging and interesting about world building is that when people have to figure out ways to build our world and make it recognizable to us, but also interesting. In other words, like the way your character describes something we've all been a part of tells us something about your character, and that's interesting. You know, when your character says, oh, this guy I met was tall. He was tall like the way my gym teacher was tall, and it was like intimidating and scary tall. Not lean, friendly, Ichabod Crane tall. It's just scary. And that tells me some stuff about your character, right? Because I'm like, okay, well, this person probably is not a big athletics type person. This person did not have a positive experience with their gym teacher. This person finds physical intimidation to be a thing. You know what I mean? Like, you can extract a lot from that. And then sometimes I feel like these books that get a lot of credit for world building are just like, well, I just make things different. We kind of have the same shit, but I give it different weird names and titles, and then the words sound foreign, and thereby I've built this world. But it's sort of like, is it really that different from our world, or is it just like I have to get used to it? And this does some good stuff. Like, I mean, okay, so they're on this desert planet, and people wear these like suits that basically recycle the moisture from their own bodies and stuff like that, which you're like, all right, that's interesting. And there are people who are somewhat psychic, and I think what's going on is they take this drug, the spice, and that helps their psychic abilities, something like that. Anyway, point being, sometimes I think the world building thing is a little overrated, or it just doesn't work for me, because I find world building to be more interesting when it's like, well, you have to build a world that's sort of more familiar to me. And just the presence of weird shit doesn't do much for me. Or the presence of like, ooh, what a weird weapon this person has. And talking about, oh, God. I mean, they were talking about the lore of this dagger that like somebody gives to somebody else. And I was just like, oh, my God, who fucking cares? You know, it's like a dagger made out of a tooth of this sandworm. And like, if it isn't in contact with human flesh or something for so long of a period, then it'll disintegrate or something. And it can never leave the planet. And it can never be viewed without drawing blood. And there's all these rules for this dagger. And it's like, sort of, this person is giving this other person this dagger as like a sign of respect or something. And I'm like, thanks for giving me this fucking chore to do with this goddamn dagger. Like, I would not be real thrilled to get this dagger from someone else. I'd be like, oh, cool, thanks for giving me a huge responsibility that's a huge pain in the ass. What a nice thing you did for me. Be like if your boss gave you extra duties or something, and they're like, well, I'm giving you these because it's an honor. It's an honor to have extra duties to do at work, and it means I trust you and value your contribution. And you're like, yeah, but it also means I got to do some extra work. Not real thrilled about that. Not real thrilled about getting this fucking dagger that has all these requirements. Thanks. Real cool. Real nice. Little torn here. Maybe you should hang on to this. I feel like there's too many... You know what? I'll just mess it up. Why don't you hang on to it? Okay? I can just have a dagger made out of something else. Anywho. So, and the basic story is this kid is programming this video game, and he's programming a video game, and it's like maybe a 1980s-ish looking style of things. So like the computers are like an 80s style of computer, and it's kind of like a a Zork type adventure. What do you call those? A text-based adventure, but it does have images and stuff. But it's not like an action platformy game where you're like swinging a sword around or something. It's one where you make decisions and it's like, oh, you got to get this key to go do this thing and so on and so forth, right? And I guess basically he's taking the book and turning it into a video game. So there's all these, you know, deviant paths and stuff you can take and whatever. But it's kind of like, it's kind of interesting because I just don't understand, like, so you could just take a book that someone made, like Dune, and make a video game based on it, and the person who made that video game or their estate or whatever is like, fuck it, like, I don't care if you do that.
Seems unlikely.
But also, so the guy who went and wrote it, like, went crazy and killed himself. So I guess that's something to know. I don't know. I don't know what that means. That's also, like, unexplored, but, you know, the show kind of asks this question of, like, did he go crazy? Or was it something about working on his book that showed him that... Whatever. So as you go on, the story kind of plays with this idea of, like, are we all sort of on a set path that we are not in control of? Are we all being manipulated by an outside force? Do we really have agency and decision making in our lives, or is kind of everything decided for us? And so it's kind of telling that story on the screen and having you do that to the character on the screen, right? So you as a participant in this are sort of being the person who sets the parameters, but then also as you're making the decisions, you kind of realize, like, the decisions I'm making aren't the ones I'd make. For example, you pretty much end up killing your dad at some point. And the choice to kill your dad, I think, was, like, hit him in the head with this thing or stab him with this thing. And I was like, wait a minute. I'm not at the level where I'm like, yeah, let's kill dad. That's a good idea. But I don't really have a choice. I'm not given a choice by this thing. And so you find out eventually, I guess, the basics of the story is this kid's trying to make this game. He kind of goes crazy. You find out that he, as a kid, like, made his mom late for a train because he couldn't find his stuffed animal. And it turned out he couldn't find the stuffed animal because the dad had taken the stuffed animal because he's like, it's not right for a boy this age to have a stuffed rabbit or whatever.
And so then he's looking for it the next morning. He can't find it.
He makes his mom late for her train. So she has to take the next train, and that train crashes and she dies. So I guess everyone left alive blames themselves for the mom's death. And that caused the kid to be kind of fucked up and has emotional problems, and the dad probably too. I don't know. And so the choices you make determine whether or not you, like, finish the video game, whether or not you kill your dad. And then you make a friend, and there's, like, a weird drug trip thing with him that's whatever. It's a thing in there. Ultimately, it's about what kind of ending you get, right? Now, there are several places where it's, like, the story sort of ends. For example, like, the first big choice you make is a video game studio is, like, do you want to work on the video game with us, or do you want to just do it solo? And if you choose to do it with them, then basically it's like cut to a couple months later, the video game comes out, it's mediocre, and that's the end. And then it tells you, like, do you want to try again? And so when it tells you, do you want to try again, that's a pretty obvious answer of, like, well, that's not the right ending. You didn't do this correctly. And that's one of my problems with the Choose Your Own Adventure format. Is while there are multiple endings, there are obviously endings that are more or less good and more or less correct. And I think that's the thing with Bandersnatch is, like, in the books it was sort of like, yeah, you could have a bad ending where you just get killed or whatever. But this one is more obvious that there is a correct ending, that it's trying to get you to continue through and find. right? That if you go through enough of these choices, and then what it kind of does is if you say, like, try again, it sends you back to the beginning, but you kind of watch the beginning in montage up to the point where you made whatever the incorrect decision was. So you sort of see everything again, all the choices you made in montage, and then it brings you right up to the place where you made the quote-unquote wrong decision. At which point you can make the wrong decision again, and it takes you down the wrong path, or you can make the right decision. And so I think there's something I don't really like about the idea of choose your own adventure, but there's like a right answer. And there's, in Bandersnatch, there's a very clear hierarchy of more and more correct. And it turns it into more of a game, because you're like trying to get to the correct answer. But I also think they didn't believe in their own concept entirely, because if they believed in their own concept, it wouldn't have the option to try again and like take you really quickly back through and montage it. It would make you start with your decisions from the beginning and, you know, figure out where you went wrong. Because I'm like, maybe I did go wrong in picking the wrong cereal. Like, I'm going to pick the other cereal this time, or the other music or something, and see what changes. And it also, I guess, I mean, what I like about it in theory is that it does, the story, the narrative, and the style kind of reinforce the same message, which is that, like, there's really no such thing as choice. It's maybe a little bit anti-butterfly effect, too, which is like, yeah, picking a different music on the bus ride into work today is not going to change your fate. And may have no actual effect on the world at all. And I like that, because it's different. I think everyone's very fascinated with the like sort of infinite web of possibilities, but I kind of think it's more interesting at this point to talk about what if there really is a very finite web of possibilities. What if the web is very contained and self-contained? Like, what if your life, even if you made big decisions, really doesn't turn out that different? You know, what if you move to another state and, like, you marry some guy and so on and so forth. And it's like, well, it's different in the specifics, but if you had stayed in your other state, you would have married a very similar person and so on. Like, who knows? Who's to say? So anyway, I don't love that. But, like, the overall thing I don't love about it, Bandersnatch, and that I think applies to all Choose Your Own Adventure, is it's just not a really great narrative outside of the format. The format adds so much novelty to it that it makes it interesting, but I think it encourages you in a more subtle way to sort of forget what the story is and to, you know, you want to beat it. And when you beat it, you get this sense of like success. And so then it's like it's a successful narrative. But to me, it's not a successful narrative because of that. Because when I think about, if I just watched this and didn't have to click and didn't have that novelty factor, I don't think I would have enjoyed it at all. Or like if someone had pitched this to me, I really think it's a little bit, it reminds me of in the post-Tarantino era of film and short stories and stuff like that. There was a real strong temptation for a lot of folks to tell a story out of order. But part of the problem there is that the being out of order was the story. Oh my God. Why do people just drive out in front of you and go like 2 miles an hour? And now then they like really hit the gas after they've driven like a tenth of a mile. And then they're like, all right, now I'm going to speed up. And you're like, why? Why didn't you just wait for me or speed up quicker? Those are great options. Anyway, the post-Tarantino era, there's a lot of stories that were told out of order, but if you told them in order, they'd be stupid and not interesting and not fun. And like Pulp Fiction, I've never watched it in order. I've heard that there is an option on like a special edition or something to watch it in order. And I think I think if you're someone who's interested in Pulp Fiction, that it's probably still compelling in order. I don't know how much the out of orderness contributed to the film's success or not. But also it was, I guess, different at that time. Or, you know, Memento had a similar effect where it's like, well, that was a movie where there's really not much of a story other than, like, he can't remember anything. But so I feel like that's caused a bunch of short stories and movies and stuff where it's like, well, we play with things, we show scenes out of order, or people discover things out of sync or whatever. And that's kind of the trick we use to make this more interesting. But sometimes it's not that interesting. That's the thing, is you got to be like, would this be interesting if it were told straight? Like, I think about Fight Club a lot with this, because people will accuse that of being like, oh my god, twist ending, and big deal. And like, we've sort of allegedly come to hate the twist ending. I don't really think we do, but we don't like when there's a story in service of a twist. But I think that would still be a pretty interesting story. It still had a lot of interesting elements in it without the twist ending. The twist ending was good, and it makes sense, and it goes along with the story. But also, I think it had so many kind of different ideas and strange ideas that it could have flown without the twist, maybe. The twist enhanced the story, and the story enhanced the twist. It wasn't just one doing the other. Whereas with Bandersnatch, I felt like the format enhanced the story, but the story didn't really feed into the format. It didn't like make the format, it didn't elevate the format of Choose Your Own Adventure in any way. Some of the endings are also pretty stupid. I mean, one is basically this guy's dead. One is that, you know, we got one that's like the meta ending, and it's like, I don't know, he's in his therapist's office, the main kid, and then they have like a ninja fight, and then it's like cut, and it's like Netflix studio, and it's sort of like, hey, this is a show you're on, but the kid is like, what? I don't understand what's happening. And you're sort of like, this ending doesn't really make sense and is obviously not a good ending. There's a portion in it too where you have to tell the kid about like Netflix, and it's like, I'm watching you on Netflix. Like, you sort of start interacting with the character. And that was probably one of the more effective and simultaneously more annoying parts of the whole thing. Because it's like, it's sort of effective because you're like, okay, now I'm stuck in the position of this character where my adventure is being chosen for me, and I don't like the choices I have. But it's also annoying because then you're like, well, what's the point of this then? If I just have to choose something and it's just going to arbitrarily have me choose, and I don't know whether what to say, like, I can't say what I want to say to this character. I have to pick from two versions of what a person could say, and neither of them are what I would say at all. So it's not choosing your own adventure anymore, but that's also kind of the point of it. I guess overall, the thing is, I just found it more frustrating than engaging. And I would have just preferred to have seen like a B+ episode of Black Mirror than to have this. Like, this was, I'm sure, a tremendous effort, and they filmed probably a ton of shit, and they probably filmed a lot of shit that no one's ever going to see. Or that people will see, but only because they, like, get on YouTube and they're like, Bandersnatch endings, and so they just see them all. Because that's kind of what we did. Me and Poon Master Flex watched it, and I was just, like, bored about halfway through, and then we got a couple endings, and I was just like, should we just, like, just look up what the other endings are? Like, are we done? And she's like, fuck yeah. And I was like, all right, cool. So yeah, I don't know. It wasn't like horrible. It wasn't like a terrible failure of a thing. And I don't even know if I would accuse them of like going for novelty, style over substance. But I think it's hard when the format is so present to talk about the substance or to even think of it as substantive. Again, it would be interesting to see a version of it where it just plays out as a show somehow. And like somebody makes all the decisions that get you the quote unquote right ending, but there's still a way within the narrative to experience the wrong endings or something. I think too, there was this thing because like one of the side characters is kind of alluding to like there's more to life than just like this one go around. Like you kind of just go around and around or something. Or you can loop back and make the same decision again or something like that. And that doesn't really pay off, in my opinion. It was kind of a big... And that's probably part of it, too. I think there's a lot in it that doesn't really pay off. I think that the dad and the son, their relationship isn't as weird as we are led to believe at the beginning. I mean, the dad is clearly afraid of the son on some level because he locks his own door and stuff, but also doesn't seem afraid of him in interactions. And then turns out to be have been right to have been afraid of him, because when the son kills the dad, I mean, obviously it's like, oh, shit. I guess you probably should have had a deadbolt on your door. But overall, it kind of feels like that doesn't pay off. This side character and the looping talk doesn't really pay off. The building of the video game is the sort of, like, entree into this world doesn't really pay off in a big way. I mean, it's like he's gonna make it and then he makes it, or he does make it and it doesn't really work, or he doesn't finish it. And it's kind of like, I mean, this seems like if someone had to do a spreadsheet on a TV show and they either finished it or they didn't. The end. And it's like, oh, all right. Ooh, that really holds a Black Mirror up to society or something. So it just wasn't satisfying, I guess, is the point. And I think part of it was it wasn't necessarily supposed to be satisfying in the way of a traditional narrative. But I think I'm also a little bit more into a groove right now of like, hey, I want, like, when I watch something or read something or whatever, I kind of want to be swept away by it a little bit more. I don't want to be thinking about it critically. I've got this, like, idea brewing in my head right now that we're all sort of taught, like, in school and stuff. Like, you know, you read these old-ass books, and we're taught that, like, to think about things critically is smart, and to just absorb things and enjoy things is dumb. And I think I've even thought this at times, but I don't feel that way anymore. Also, I feel that some things are, like, smart in that they sort of are compelling to us even if there's not much substance there. And whoever made it found a way to make it very compelling. Like, I don't think that Terminator or Terminator 2 is a super crazy set of ideas that's like, oh my god, you know, who could have ever come up with something so insane? But the movie is so well made that you're like totally drawn in and interested and you like buy into it. That's the thing. You kind of just buy it and you don't have to. You want to buy it because you're like, I want to see what happens. And sometimes I think we undervalue that form of entertainment and overvalue the like, let's look at this through a critical lens. Because looking at some things through a critical lens is warranted, but some things I'm sort of like, eh. I don't know, I mean, are you really doing anyone a service by looking at this through a hypercritical lens and pointing out things that could be or could not be? I don't know. And so, that's the thing, though, is I think that this episode of Black Mirror in particular is maybe a little bit too much for me, divorced from the idea of entertainment, and seems to be trying to make a philosophical argument. Which I also don't like because I don't like a thing that really tells you how to feel about something. I was reading part of a James Baldwin book for a class I'm taking, and it was kind of talking about the narrator. We were reading part of Beloved. which I hadn't read since like I first was in college or something. And basically, I felt like part of the importance of the narration in that book is that it's non-judgmental, because it tells you about some pretty fucked up shit, and some different people have done some horrible things and had their reasons and all this different stuff. And I think it has to sort of be that way. Like, I think that book has to sort of be told that way, because otherwise, if you were told how to feel about all this different stuff, eventually you as a reader would either be like, wait a minute, I don't feel that way about this. Or you as a reader might be like, I feel like you were trying to tell me to feel this way about this stuff, but now I'm kind of changing my mind and you're helping me change my mind. So I feel a little bit like my trust has been betrayed here, because you were telling me to feel one way and now you're telling me to feel another way about the same thing based on new information. And so, like, I just... Boy, I don't know where that all was going. I think it's just like I didn't feel... I was not entertained by Bandersnatch. I think that's the point I want to make. I did feel like it was telling me how to feel, which is sort of like the one thing that I think a reader is supposed to do. And I really, really hate books that tell you how to feel about something. I think books, even like nonfiction books, I think it's great if they tell you what happened and if they give you other people's perspective on things and even go so far as to be like, here's my opinion on this. Like, this is a mistake I think that, you know, Enemy podcast Serial made in the first season. Because I know at the end of season one, it was like the host did not comment on really whether or not she thought Adnan Syed was guilty. And I understand that choice. But at the same time, I was like, why don't you tell us how you feel? Like, I think that there's I think it's possible to separate how the teller of the story feels from about things and how the listener feels. And I think making that point is really important, right? To say things like, I don't want to influence how you feel. I don't want to tell you how to feel about this. And here's something else you should know is I don't know. However, I, as the person who put this podcast together, probably know as much about this as anyone can possibly know other than Adnan Syed. Like, that is the only other person who could know, who knows more definitively than I do at this point, whether or not this thing happened, or how it happened, or whether or not he was involved. Right? Like, I don't know, or, you know, Making a Murderer, I felt... definitely had a slant to it that was like he didn't do it and whatever, and I had some feelings about that, but I didn't feel like that show was trying to make me feel a certain way. I think it was trying to show that he was not guilty, but I also felt that it wasn't trying to make me feel a way about this person. I didn't feel like emotionally manipulated or whatever. And maybe they were doing that. I didn't feel successfully emotionally manipulated, and it could be my own blind spot. But there you go. I just didn't feel that way. But I think it's especially bad in a fictional narrative. I think it's an interesting thing, too. It seems like a current zeitgeist kind of thing where even in a fictional novel, you have to be careful to say things like, I don't know, you have to be careful to depict certain characters a certain way, or you couldn't have a character in a novel say something bad about a gay person, you know, like call them a name or whatever, without having someone else in the novel be like, hey, that's not cool, or like somehow disavowing or, you know, making that character the enemy, the other, right? Like that character does not represent the views of the author, the publisher, or any subsidiaries. Like, it's almost like people want that. They want to know what the author thinks because then they know how to feel about it. So I think Serial, though, could have gone further and say, I don't think it was a sin for that person to say how they felt about it. Because also, obviously, they felt one way about it at some point. Because you wouldn't even get involved with that unless you were like, this seems pretty fishy. You know, like making a murderer, I certainly, by the end of that, I felt very much like, you know, okay, Brendan Dassey, I feel is innocent. Steve Avery, I don't know that he's innocent. But I do think there's enough fucked up weird shit going on here that warrants some more investigation. It just, even from the get-go, it seems so weird and unlikely. And it seemed like they got an awfully harsh conviction on this guy on not real great evidence. And, you know, you don't even have to be super conspiratorial to be like, well, isn't it weird that, like, there was this other police department searching the property because this, you know, local police weren't even supposed to touch anything. But then the local police were there, and then they magically found something after the property had been gone over several times. And, like, isn't it weird that these stories don't match up at all? And, like, isn't it weird that this sort of feels like what we're saying is this dude's got to prove his innocence, even though it should be innocent until proven guilty? And that's like, and isn't it weird that this all happened in the midst of, you know, Steve Avery getting this huge settlement and whatever? And like, isn't it weird that he doesn't really have a motive to kill this person, but the county certainly has a motive to go after him? Isn't it weird that the same cops still work there? I mean, even if they convicted him and think that they're right and whatever, isn't there anybody who's like, listen, guys, you fucked up a lot of shit. And like, listen, guys, when the order of the day is we're going to search this Steve Avery's house, and you guys are not to touch anything because that is going to fuck up the evidence. The defense attorneys are going to be like, we planted that shit. I don't want you near that place. I want you hanging out at the police station all fucking day so that I can, and we're going to have you wear body cams, and I better see all the footage because I don't want you fucking this up. Like, if you really thought that this guy was guilty, wouldn't you go to like any lengths to keep everyone away so that you're like, I don't even want a whiff of the possibility that we tampered with the evidence. I don't want any of that shit. Hey, buddy, when you find that car that's supposed to be the girl's car and supposedly Steve Avery did this and that to it, I don't want anybody, I don't want you to touch it. I want you to park right next to it, as far away as you can be from it, and I don't want you to leave your car until somebody gets there from, you know what I mean? Like, all this shit. So anyway, overall, I'm just sort of like, I don't know if I think that he's guilty or not, but I do think that it's an awfully sketchy case. And seems like maybe he shouldn't have been convicted based on what they brought. They didn't bring a whole lot to the table that proved to me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it was him. And like, all the shit too, where they're just like, here's a fake story we made up. And then it's like, none of this is provable. And it's like, okay, well, That takes me in an interesting direction. Anyway, I just felt like Bandersnatch was trying to make its point, and kind of, rather than telling me a story that was good or whatever, it was really focused on making me complicit and thereby making its point. And making me feel what the character feels, which is that, like, fate is not something I have any control over. And I'm fine with that message. I don't think it's the message. It's the delivery and the sort of insistence on the correctness of it that it's sort of, that's where it lost me. Let's talk about the AI novel, because this is kind of a similar topic. And someone brought it up on Lit Reactor in the community the other day. You know, I gotta go there every day and delete like 25 fucking spam ads about ketogenesis and stuff. They're all spawning from the same country. And I guess this country shares an IP with Australia. So part of the problem is we can't block these IPs because then it would block Australia as well. But I'm kind of getting to the point of, like, there's got to be something we can do here because this is crazy. And also, I don't know. I don't know if I totally believe our tech guy because I feel like I don't get on other websites and see this. So why am I seeing it here? And he's like, well, we've got a CAPTCHA that is supposed to work. And I was like, well, yeah, it's not. The problem isn't that it's bots. The problem is that it's people posting spam. But I'm kind of like, maybe we just need to take the hyperlinking out. And especially it's like, can't you change it? So you can't put a hyperlink as the title of your post. Like, couldn't we disallow that somehow? If your title has HTTP in it, guess what? It's just going to go away or not be allowed. That would get rid of like 90% of them. Anywho, we were having a discussion about literary magazines shutting down because someone was like, Tin House is closing down this year, which is like a big one. It's a big literary magazine. But I'm not super surprised because like these literary magazines kind of operate. I'm sure their budgets are pretty thin. And I think a lot of literary magazines kind of operate as a passion project on some level. I'm sure there's people getting paid, but also I'm sure they get a lot of interns and students and things like that who keep it running. And also, though, I think that it's like now we live in this world where it's like, well, I could read Glimmer Train and find, which sounds like a type of weed, which probably it is. I could read the literary magazine Glimmer Train and maybe find a new writer that I really like and short story and stuff. But I think the world is so abundance driven and we have so much access to stuff that it's kind of like, do I really need that right now? I mean, I have like 15 short story books at home that I haven't even read yet. That I'm like, this might be an awesome book, and I should probably read that before I start exploring. I'm not really out of writers yet that I'm interested in or want to explore further, right? Anywho, part of this discussion was someone was saying, like, well, the AI novel is coming, you know what I mean? And so that'll change everything. And I agree with this person. Like, I do agree with the concept that, like, yeah, it's only a matter of time till an artificial intelligence writes a novel. And there'll be much debate over the goodness of this novel because I don't have faith that whoever programs the AI that writes the novel, I don't have faith in their ability to keep a lid on it and, like, send that novel through a typical publication process. Also, I think that, like, what will happen is publishing houses will eventually be looking for an AI novel because they'll be like, well, this will be a big thing. People are going to buy this and read it because they're curious to find out what's the deal with the AI novel. Is it good? Is it worth it? Is this the future? Is this part of the future? But then part of the problem with that is to really know that the AI novel has arrived, I think they'd have to do it sort of like an author would do a pseudonym, which is to say, like, okay, Stephen King starts publishing as Richard Bachman because he wants to, like, kind of wants to see if he can do it this other way and see if the work stands on its own and stuff like that. Or J.K. Rowling did her, I don't even remember what her other name was, but she had this other name. She was writing some mysteries and stuff, which did okay. Like, they did pretty well, and then everyone found out it was her, and they did better. But, like, she was doing that, right? She was like, well, I want to find out if I've got the chops, and it's like, hey, it looks like you got the chops. It's a weird thing. Like, authors do seem obsessed with this idea of putting out a pseudonymous novel to sort of test their might, as we might say in Mortal Kombat terminology. And make sure that they, like, actually are good at writing. Which is such a strange, it's an understandable impulse, because I think they want to be like, well, I feel like there's so much chance to this. You know, I got picked up on this, and then off the steam of that, I got this, and this, and this. But I also wonder if people do that, if novelists do that, more to prove to the world that they're good and to take that other argument out of the picture, because like, what if you did that and then it wasn't successful? Then you've just proven to yourself, I guess. What have you proven? You've proven that there's an element of chance in publishing? Like, no fucking shit. And also, it's by chance that you get published, and also by chance that you don't get published. So, like, if you're just a J.K. Rowling, and you're submitting, just doing a slush pile submission, which I don't think is what was happening, by the way. As a published author, like a J.K. Rowling or a Stephen King, you do have access to people and, like, methods and just insider knowledge that a non-published author who just, like, is some person in Ohio would not have. Right? So it's not a perfect experiment by any stretch. But I don't think it's meant to be. I think it seems like kind of an ego trip, because then you can, as an author, point to that and be like, aha, see, I did this. And it's like, okay, big fucking deal. Anywho. Anyway. Anyhow, the AI novel. So I think it's coming. I think it'll exist. I think at some point an AI will be programmed to write a novel that mimics a human novel. And so what I mean by that is I read this fascinating thing in, it was a linguistics class in college. And it was kind of about like how humans are the only things with the capacity to really talk and form thoughts into words and stuff. And it was like a common thing people will say is like parrots can talk, but parrots can only mimic. And it's like, well, what's the difference? Aren't I just mimicking what my parents did and what I hear and stuff like that? And it's like, no, because here's the difference. You can train a parrot to say Polly wants a cracker, and you can train a parrot, that same parrot, to say Polly would like some water. That parrot will never say Polly would like a cracker, understanding that that is like the same thing, right? Like, they won't understand that those phrases are switchable or have a similar synonymous type meaning. So they'll never create like a new way of speaking intentionally, or they'll never create a new syntax or that kind of thing. They're pretty much locked into what they learn, hence a mimic. It's kind of like, think about this, like, they used to have this toy called the Yak Back, and it was like, you'd push a button on it and hold it down, and you could record, like, I don't know, 15 seconds of audio, and then play it back. You couldn't record that audio and then have it spit out a synonymous phrase, right? So the question kind of starts to become, like, is AI sophisticated enough now to create new things? And I think it is. I'm sure it probably is. It's also sophisticated enough to understand new creation of text and so in syntax and so on and so forth. But I think there's still some big hobbling points for an AI. I think for one thing, okay, I wouldn't count it as an AI novel if you're like, here's what we did. I had an author, like a well-known author, start their career when they were like in their 20s. And then the whole time they were typing, we kind of tracked the initial creation of drafts. And then we, from there, tracked the changes that were made to drafts. And then we, you know, the finished product and so on and so forth. And like all of that information could be pumped into a computer. And then it's like, theoretically, okay, so then theoretically that computer could learn to make the same sorts of things that this author made, right? And then you could do that with multiple authors. But would the AI then be, if the AI, and then it was like, okay, now write a novel. So here's one of the problems, I think, of how we think about AIs and how they work, which is like, well, you've got an AI that's designed to take all this information in, but then is it designed to spit it back out, or is it designed to create something new with the synthesis of those things? And those two AIs are not the same thing, right? That's where I think we confuse machine learning with human learning, which is like, we are designed to synthesize things and then like create our own version of it. And, you know, there's, like, so many experiences and things. It's almost like... Part of me believes to have the true AI novel, you would have to create an AI with... I don't know how it could, without consciousness, if it could write a novel. And also, I don't know if it could without experiences outside of the act of writing. Because, in other words, it's sort of like asking a writer, where do the ideas come from? Because the AI is not going to have that portion, right? The AI is going to see the ideas show up if you put them in as input and so on and so forth. But it doesn't really see how those were generated. And I don't know that it can recreate the process by which those are generated. Because I don't even know... Well, I think it's been proven that not all humans could do that. And not all humans could do it on the same level. But I don't know if we have a strong proof of why. You know, my brain probably looks kind of similar to a lot of other brains. Or, you know, a brain that of a person who's read a bunch of books probably has a lot of the same connections as a person who's written a book. But it doesn't work exactly the same way. And I do think there's a certain element of... It doesn't have to be specific to the person experiences. But experience drives the way you perceive the world. And that's another thing is an AI existent that A, can get this input, basically live a life, let's say, and then B, synthesize that for a purpose that it understands, like what it's trying to do. So I think an AI will probably be able to do all of this at some point, because never say never. But I think it's further away than we like to think. I think the sophistication of an AI that can write a novel from scratch seems really in reach because we don't really understand that the AI that can, you know, give you targeted ads is really not that sophisticated. Or like the AI that makes Google give you the results you're looking for is not super sophisticated in that in like trying to explain what it does, right? Because my understanding of what it does is it's like, well, it's basically taking searches that other people have done and looking at the results that they went to and then taking those results as quote unquote correct. And so therefore, when the next person makes that same search, they get those correct results more up top, right? They don't have to search as far to get to those quote unquote correct results. And so I just think it's more sophisticated than we think. And maybe we don't fully understand it. And that's why we think it's so close on the horizon. When really, I don't think it's as close on the horizon. But here's the other question. And this is a question that I think computer science especially should be asking. Science should always ask. But computer science really needs to get better about asking this question, which is, can we is the question. And everyone, I think, is on the can we question when it comes to computer science. But the real question is, should we? And that's the one that I think is a lot more interesting when it comes to the AI novel, because I say no. And here's why I say no. It's a pretty basic concept. Can we make an AI that can paint a painting? Of course. I think it's just like a novel at some point. Will be able to create an AI that can paint a painting. But, and maybe this is a good thing. Like, maybe the AI novel is a good thing for consumers of literature because it's interesting for them, and maybe the AI is able to understand things about what consumers of literature want that humans don't really understand. That's possible. However, I think it's a very bad thing for the creators of pictures, of books, of these things. I think it's a bad thing for creators. And the reason I think it's bad is because I think, isn't the purpose of machines and machine learning and all of this stuff, shouldn't the purpose be that, like, my job is easier and therefore I can spend less time doing it and therefore I have more time to live life? This was kind of, I think, the promise of AI, But, you know, even of manufacturing, of email, of all this stuff, it was basically like, well, if you can do business so quickly, wouldn't that make it much easier for all of us to do business? And therefore, like, you know, in the year 2000, we'll only have to work 20 hours a week to accomplish the same amount of work. But I don't think we caught up to that in terms of our ideas. And in other words, I think that, like, we think, okay, well, now I can accomplish the same amount in a much shorter time, which is totally true. We can use a lot fewer resources to accomplish the same thing, which is totally true. But therefore, we're going to have to do more. And the work week, instead of getting shorter, I think has gotten longer, because how many of us check our work email when we're not, quote unquote, at work? So many people I know check their work email from home, which I think is like a bad thing to do, because A, you should be getting paid when you work. B, they already keep us there 40 hours a week. And if we're there 40 hours a week, that should be enough. If they need more from us, they should be paying for more or hiring more people to divide the work, not basically getting the work for free because they're like, it's kind of our expectation that you'll constantly be reachable. And it's like, well, I don't like that concept. I don't think that works. I think that's kind of bullshit, to be honest with you. And I do think it's sort of hurtful to the environment, too, of the office, because, you know, when someone in my similar position is like, I'll be on email sporadically because I'm on vacation for 2 weeks, but I'm going to check in on whatever. And I'm like, no, don't check in. Just be gone. And, you know, people will try to reach you, and I'm sure something, quote unquote, urgent will happen. And it's like, well, they're just going to have to figure it out without you. I mean, things will have to continue without you. It'll have to be for these 2 weeks like you don't exist. And that's fine. Everything is going to be fine. And we do this. Like, we do this if someone gets very sick and they're out for an extended period. Like, we figure a way to carry on without them. So I think we can carry on for 12 hours without other people. Any individual. If any business can't go the weekend without somebody, then it's like, all right, well, then you've got a problem. Then you need to hire someone to do this work on the weekend. If that's what we need. I mean, look at it like this. It's not like, you know, you work at Home Depot and they're like, okay, well, you got to be reachable by email at all times because what if we need you on Saturday? And it's like, well, if you need me on Saturday, fucking hire someone to work on Saturday then. The end. Anywho, I think that the point of, I keep saying anywho, and then I get mad at myself because I don't like saying that. But it's just stuck in my head now. It's like a song stuck in my head. I believe that one of the problems we have is that we have become a lot more efficient, but we've also stuck to this idea of like FaceTime in the office, spend 40 hours a week here in the office. And so many jobs too have moved to service instead of accomplishing certain things, you know, certain this many units per hour, or this many units of whatever, or so on and so forth. I think that when you move to service industry, it's sort of like, well, you just got to fucking be there. You got to be open. You got to be there for whatever comes in the door. And so instead of utilizing technology to lessen our work, we've just done it to do, I think, more work, but maybe the same amount of work more efficiently and just have sort of more downtime in between little tasks. And all of this adds up to me to be very stupid. And it's all, I don't know. If I was going to get all political about it and talk about universal basic income, which I think would be great, because then my real pitch for that is sort of like, don't you hate fucking going to places and the people who work there like do not want to be there? Wouldn't this eliminate that almost completely? And, you know, universal basic income does not mean that everyone's living a wealthy lifestyle if they're not working. It just means like, hey, if you're working, you wouldn't have to work to survive. right? Like, you wouldn't have to do a shitty job you didn't like. And also, you could do a job that's, like, maybe simpler, or maybe do part-time at your job and not get totally fried and be like, oh, yeah, well, I've got the UBI plus what I'm making at work, so I'm going pretty well now. Like, it would be very easy for me to go down to 32 hours a week with a small supplemental income, right? Okay, regardless, I think the thing about an AI writing a novel is that, to me, it's like, to what end? Does that make society happier? Does it make society happier to have books written by a machine as opposed to a person? Because let's look at what you remove. I think people think that what they would remove, for example, is a barrier, which is like, well, you wouldn't have to pay an AI author, right? It's like, yeah, but who do you think's going to have that technology? I can tell you right now who's going to have that technology is fucking Amazon. And do you think they're going to just sell the or give away the AI novel for free because they're like, well, technically this doesn't cost anything? No, fuck that. There's no way. Do we think that the AI novel is going to remove, like, human bias from things? Because that's not going to be true. Because anything is programmed, you know, is going to have some level of the bias of its programmer, whether they know it or not, whether it's intentional or not. It's going to have a slant to it. That's not, it doesn't exist until, like, I mean, I guess if the singularity comes and then machines are making themselves and it's sort of like, all right, well, it may have a non-human bias now. And also, okay, so now you don't have the human-to-human connection. You finish that book and you haven't really understood another human better. Because at the bare minimum, you read a book and you're like, well, I know some of what was going on inside the mind of this other person. And I know some of how they express themselves and some of what they think and say and so on, right? With the AI novel, you don't have that anymore. Like, you don't have any version of that. And I don't think that that's going to come through on a machine-created piece of art. So I think it's like, the basic of what I'm saying here is like, didn't we make machines and stuff so we could spend more time doing things like writing novels? And painting paintings and doing stuff like that, things we enjoy being with our families. Sort of like, yeah, I could have a hologram boyfriend version of myself and just program it. So that it's like, but then it's like, okay, cool. So now I don't have to spend time with my girlfriend. Like, I don't spend time doing that. What am I doing with that time then? If we have creating an AI that writes a novel, I think is an interesting experiment for someone in computer science. But like the idea that novels in general will be written by AIs is dumb. Because it's like, yeah, why would we take fulfilling useful work away from people and give it to machines? You want to give crap work to machines. As we used to call it, bitch work. Stupid crap. You know, do I want a machine that would just pick up stuff from my desk and shred it for me? Yeah. Because that I don't need to do. That is not fulfilling for me to do that. That doesn't really require any skill or thought or anything. Would it be great to have a robot that I could be like, here's a big stack of journals. Can you digitize these for me? And it would be like, sure. And then, you know, the next day it's done. I'd be like, fuck yeah, that's way better. That is way better use of time. But do I want an AI? Do I want to be like, here, listen to this album for me and then kind of tell me what it's like? Or like, do I want to go to a book club and be like, hey, AI, read this book for me and then tell me what it's about on the way to book club? Sure, sometimes I do, but that's like when I didn't like the book, right? When I shouldn't have been fucking reading the book anyway because it's not good or I'm not enjoying it. Just quit. You don't have to finish the book to go to book club, guys. You have to finish it if you like it. And then you don't want to get it spoiled for you. because you're like, I'm definitely finishing this. But you don't have to like it, or you don't have to finish it if you don't like it, and you're not going to finish it, then fuck it. Show up and tell them you didn't finish it and why. But so, like, is that a good use of AI? Is watching a computer... People are teaching computers to play, like, Super Mario Brothers, right? And at some point, yeah, a computer is going to be way better at playing Super Mario Brothers than a human, because it can program in, you know, exact precise movements. It understands. It can do calculations so quickly that eventually, I'm sure, you could give a computer a video game and it could learn how to play it in a video game and be really good at it. But is that satisfying? Is that satisfying to, like, buy a gaming console and then have the game beat the game? You'd be like, oh yeah, my AI can beat the game. It would be if you were the person who programmed it. But are we going to have, like, AI that you could just buy? Like, the Nintendo Switch has an AI you can buy for it, and it's like, this will beat the games for you. It's like, I don't know. I don't really know if I would like that. I don't think that's a good thing. Because I guess I just sort of believe that, like, A, people need useful, interesting things to do with their lives. And B, I guess I think that it defeats the purpose of AI if we're not doing those things. If we're not doing interesting, useful things, then, like, why are we bothering? What's the point? I don't even know. It's a little bit like exercise, I think. Like, I think things will happen, you know, where you can take a pill or do whatever, or nano machines or something, where maybe we won't need to exercise anymore. Like, the human body won't need it. But I wonder about, like, the mind. What happens to the mind if we're not doing that? And is there something about exercising that is fulfilling to us and helpful? And, like, is there something about just putting on sneakers and pounding the pavement for a couple hours that it can't be, you don't get the benefits from it unless you actually do it? And where are those things? What are those things that we actually have to do in order to derive benefit? And are those things we should be turning over to machines? So anyway, I put the creation of art in the category of things that people should do for the benefit of doing it, not necessarily for the book sales and so on. And therefore, I don't think the AI novel is necessarily a good thing. I'm sure it'll happen. And I'm sure there'll be much debate over whether or not it's actually good. And I'm sure an AI novel will eventually sneak its way into legitimate publication and so on. And then it'll be revealed and it's like, oh my God. I'm sure all of those things will happen, and I'm sure once AI gets sophisticated enough to have some kind of personality, then doing something like writing a novel will be a natural step in that progression. But that's where I start to wonder if it's a good thing. You know, that's where I start to wonder, like, is it to our human benefit to have these things created for us without having to learn anything, do any work, and have any experiences? And when we do that, what are we going to do with all of our fucking free time? What good productive things are going to come out of that? I would be sort of surprised if... I think people are going to be more depressed, honestly. And, like, I think that useful work is dying and will probably be dead at some point. And so we're all just kind of doing shit because we're supposed to do shit because that's just sort of what we're doing. But wouldn't it be nice if it's like, hey man, some people like building houses, and so maybe they should be building houses. Like, maybe machines should be building some houses. If you're building a straight up fucking rectangular apartment building where all the apartments are the same, and that's an answer to affordable housing because it's like, it goes up quick. It's precise, it's built well, you don't have to pay people to do it, and so on and so forth. Great. But shouldn't someone still be building like custom cabins and shit like that? I mean, isn't that still something people like? Or shouldn't those, I mean, what are those workers going to do when they don't have that job? Where are they going? It's like they're going to be in service industry too. We're all just going to be service industry. Because it's like, oh, well, I like to see a smiling face when I go here. And it's like, yeah, well, those faces ain't going to be fucking smiling. All right. That was a long, long rant about something that's just sort of like Peter's opinion on stuff. But some food for thought, I guess, huh? On the AI novel. What are the effects really going to be? I think that a lot of times we just think about market effect and we think about it as an interesting experiment, but we don't necessarily think about like, okay, why do people write novels to begin with? And does this enhance or make that worse? Does this make life better or worse if this works? Maybe we should ask that question, huh? All right, that's enough. Enough. Enough already. I'll see you next time. Stop bothering me.
You're not gonna say it. Somebody should. Let's talk about two times. Let's talk about bum one, yeah. Asking the questions that nobody could. Like, where are the bone dogs and are they in harmony?